On the program today, we are going to play another round of What the Heck with This Economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 17th day of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are just going to jump right in. What happened in this economy this week and why it matters. Kate Davidson's at Bloomberg. Jordan Holman is at the New York Times. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Kate, let me start with you. And I want to start with inflation. We got the consumer price index. We got the producer price index this week, both showing inflation still very much alive and well. And I guess I wonder if after the Fed chair's press conference, what, like 10 days ago, when he started talking about disinflation, I wonder if we all started to go, oh, OK, inflation's kind of on the way down. And maybe it is. But this week, these numbers showed it's still very real.
Yeah, I think it underscores how bumpy this process is going to be, right? It's not a straight line. And I do actually think that Fed Chair Powell and the other members of the FOMC understand this, which I think is part of the reason why they're continuing to lean into this idea that we need or that they need to raise rates further. A few more times, maybe more than twice. So, the markets are kind of expecting at least a couple more. But now, as you said this week, those expectations are drifting up a little bit. There could be a third rate hike. And I think that's because they really want to be certain. They don't want to be in a situation like they've been in before where, right, it starts to look pretty good and then all of a sudden it's on the way up again. So it's bumpy.
I want you to hold that thought, actually, on the bumpy because I want to get back to that. But Jordan, I do want to touch on the other big indicator that came out this week, retail sales. Robust consumers still are willing to and almost eager to spend money.
Absolutely. So retail sales in January were up 3% and pretty much across every category had a bump. And that was surprising because usually January is a slower month coming off of the holiday season. But it's just kind of going to what Kate said, showing that even though the Fed is doing what it's doing, it might have dimmed consumer spending, especially a few months ago, but it hasn't cooled it off completely. So that's for a lot of factors that people have. But what is clear is that people still have money in their wallets and are going out to spend across the board.
Kate, this is not a fair question, and I'm going sideways from the whole bumpy thing. But why do you suppose, despite what the Fed is doing, this economy is not reacting? The labor market is robust. Consumers are confident. The economy overall is growing. What the what?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's for the reasons you just said, right? People are still, they're getting jobs. The labor market is still very tight. People are still seeing wage increases, even though those have come down a little bit. I kind of have to wonder, and we're not seeing this in the data quite yet, although officials are worried about it, but are people just getting used to higher prices? Are they kind of just like, well, it is what it is. I want to go out. I want to go out to eat. I want to go out and go on vacations and see my friends and have fun, go to concerts. I don't know. It is a big mystery, though, right now.
And then what happens, Jordan, if consumers get used to those higher prices, then those consumers are also employees. The employees will go to their bosses and say, we need raises. And then that just keeps things going, right?
Absolutely. And then those companies, I guess the bosses at the companies say, great, we're going to keep the prices high. Right. And it just continues the cycle all over again. And in earnings calls, like with Coca-Cola, they said the same thing, People aren't shirking at our prices. And so that, I think that's exactly right. We kind of get used to having higher prices. And at this point, it's been really a year of this conversation about high inflation. So the question becomes, do we even have an expectation that we go back anymore?
Right. And thus those expectations get unanchored and Jay Powell loses sleep. But look, Kate, let me ask you this. There has been a lot of talk, obviously, the last, 5, 6, 8 months about a soft landing. Here's what I want to ask you about. There is now chatter out there, and you're seeing this in a lot of reports, of people saying, you know what, maybe we're just never going to land. Maybe we don't have to have everything come down softly or hard. Why is no landing bad, or is no landing bad?
Well, that's a really good question. So, I mean, I think Fed officials would say that getting inflation under control is essential to have a healthy and strong labor market, right? So there are folks out there that are saying, you know, the Fed doesn't need to keep raising rates so aggressively. They don't need to knock the economy off course. They don't need to jack up unemployment to bring inflation way down. And there's even people saying, you know, they might need to adjust their inflation target. They, you know, their goal is 2%, but some people are saying, well, why do we have to get back to 2%? And Fed officials still very much are of the view that, you know, higher prices, inflation, high inflation, it eats away at people's earnings. It's really, you know, it's really burdensome for folks, especially at the lower end of the income scale. And it's just an essential part of having a robust, healthy labor market. Yes, you don't want employment to go very high or people to lose their jobs, but they see it as, you know, as a trade-off for, you know, getting prices under control. They see that as a worthy trade-off.
All right, Kate, I want to stick with you, and then I want to finish with Jordan on retail for a second. But talk to me about this bumpy data, right? It's bouncing all around, has been for a while. You know, labor market numbers come in, and they're 200,000, 500,000, 190, whatever. How hard does that make it for us to know what is going on in this economy?
Oh, it's really hard. I mean, I thought it was interesting that Jay Powell said at his press conference that the Labor Department data, the jobs data, showed 500,000 jobs added in January. Just a wild number, blew expectations out of the water. That was high quality data. I mean, I think that everyone, you know, thinks that the folks at the Labor Department are doing the absolute best they can. They're pros for sure, but there is weird stuff going on that just can distort the numbers somewhat. And so I think that that makes it challenging. I think also when it comes to the inflation data, there are factors that we know are going to influence the numbers. For example, we know that rents are expected to come down. So that's something that's going to hopefully take some of the, you know, the heat off of the inflation figures. But we also know that goods disinflation, which has been happening, is expected to level off, and that could push it the other way. So there's lots of cross-cutting factors here.
So many cross-cutting factors. Jordan, I want to finish with a piece you had in the paper this week in about 45 seconds or a minute about the challenge that retail companies are having finding CEOs. It's now a different world than it was for retail CEOs 4 or 5 years ago.
Absolutely. So 4 or 5 years ago, or I guess if you take the long spectrum, for the past few decades, a CEO in a retail company needs to be a merchant, someone who sells really well. But because of all the factors that we've been talking about with the rockiness in the economy, with slowing consumer demand, with all the pricing challenges, they're looking for so many more skills. And the question is, can you find that in one person? And what it's creating in the retail sector is a lot of turnover, a lot of open positions, which isn't super ideal at a time when you need a solid leader to lead the company.
And what they're finding is they can't find those people. It was a super interesting article.
Thank you. Yeah. And no one really knows what the right skill is today. So that's the huge question in the industry.
Jordan Holman writing on retail in the New York Times. Kate Davidson doing a bunch of stuff in Bloomberg. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, things were, you know, to use a phrase, a little bumpy, uneven, perhaps. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Confusion over what exactly is going on in this economy, the what, if you will, exists on a couple of levels. The macro, why the labor market doesn't seem to be slowing down in spite of all those rate hikes from the Fed, for instance. But also on the micro, consumers and how we are supposed to know what's going on. Jordan talked about retail a couple of minutes ago. People still spending money on cars and furniture and electronics. But at the same time, surveys still do show that people are worried about inflation and the chance of recession. A new survey, that is, from PwC says 96% of consumers say they are going to start doing some cost saving over the next 6 months. In other words, there is a disconnect between what people say and what they do. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab is here to explain what gives.
When times get uncertain, people look for ways to trim some fat. Colin Jordan in Scottsdale, Arizona, recently left a blockchain startup to open his own marketing company. And for him, the fat is his lunch salad.
Now I have to, you know, get up a little bit earlier, make something for breakfast, make something for lunch. You know, we save a lot of money that way.
Saving with plans to spend. His family's taking a trip to Europe soon. It was originally for his grandma's 80th birthday, but got postponed because of COVID. She just turned 83.
Who knows when we would get to be able to do this again? So I will eat ramen for the next 6 months if I have to.
We're still reeling from the pandemic, and it shows up in how we spend money. Joanne Hsu, who directs the surveys for consumers at the University of Michigan, says we've been living through 3 years of economic craziness.
We have this period of pandemic, inflation, all this uncertainty, political polarization.
How tiring, because we've had our defenses up for so long. And how confusing, because we're bracing for a recession while unemployment is historically low. Hsu says this is why there's a mismatch between what we say and what we do.
Because consumers aren't responding to just one slice of the economy, they're responding to their entire experience.
That's why you might fall into this pattern of budgeting while splurging. Ravi Dhar directs the Yale Center for Customer Insights.
For example, if you stop eating out in an upscale restaurant, that suddenly allows you to actually spend more money on DoorDash.
He says this can lead to saving, but also more spending on a cup of coffee or a tube of lipstick.
And the affordable luxuries, as they call them, they can actually increase in sales because of the stressful moments that people have in their lives.
Save money by staying in on a Friday night and lighting that new lavender candle you just bought to make yourself feel better? Just a hypothetical. But hey, it makes sense to me. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Whether you were buying, I don't know, a teddy bear for your significant other or chocolates for yourself, no judgment here, by the way, Valentine's Day is big business. The National Retail Federation was guessing Americans would spend an average of $192 each to celebrate the day. Comes to $25.9 billion all in, which, I mean, that's a lot of flowers, you know? We got Kristen Tallheimer-Bingham. She's the co-owner of Dean's Sweets in Portland, Maine. We got her on the phone to see how the holiday went.
Valentine's Day was great this year. Very successful. Compared to last year, we had an increase of about 55%. I was surprised and really pleased to see that number. What's interesting to me, though, is that even though sales were quite up for the day before and the day of Valentine's Day, the trend has been somewhat down for us recently. Of course, I can't say exactly why that is. There are so many factors. But what it feels like is kind of a contraction. It feels like people are spending less or not allowing themselves the small luxuries that they used to, which of course is what chocolate is, a small luxury, although many people do consider it essential. But Valentine's Day kind of bucked this recent trend for us. There was definitely a holiday kind of mood for the last few days. Unlike the December holidays and unlike Easter, most people wait until the very last minute to get Valentine's Day gifts. I joke with people who come into our stores even 3 days ahead of time that they are way ahead of the curve. I'm not sure why Valentine's Day is like that. It's almost like it's part of the tradition to wait to buy a gift. People seem to almost enjoy the camaraderie of waiting in line to get their chocolate. It's a bit of a party atmosphere at some points in our stores. It's fun, but it makes it difficult to know how much to make when everyone comes in on the same day. The biggest challenge right now is to come down off of the craziness of Valentine's Day, take a day to rest, and then jump right back in to get ready for Easter. Or maybe I should have said hop right back in for Easter. The chocolate bunny orders are actually already starting, so there's not much of a break. We'll rest a little more after Easter, or maybe really after Mother's Day.
Solid chocolate bunnies only, please. Those hollow ones, no thank you. Kristen Tallheimer-Bingham of Dean Sweets in Portland, Maine. Coming up.
They are some of the poorest investments you can make.
Looking at you, newly finished basement. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 129 today, 0.4%, 33,826. The NASDAQ down 68 points, almost 0.6%, 11,787. The S&P 500 fell 11 points, 0.3%, 4,079. For the 5 days going by, the week that was, the Dow shed about 0.1%, the NASDAQ gained 0.6%. S&P 500 went the other way, off 0.3%. We heard Kristen Schwab talking about consumers saying they plan to cut back on spending, but do they? In some immediate gratification stocks, DoorDash closed down 0.7%. Wayfair moved up 1.4%. Macy's pretty much unchanged. AMC, the meme stock and owner of cable channels, a streaming service, and a movie theater chain, posted strong fourth quarter results today. Nonetheless, AMC flopped 0.2%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Tucked away in the big infrastructure deal that became law in late 2021 was more than $40 billion to expand broadband internet connectivity in areas that don't have it or don't have enough of it. Figuring out, though, exactly where all that money should go is challenging, and the Federal Communications Commission says big telecom isn't really helping out. The FCC says it's looking into systematic overreporting of coverage by those broadband providers, which doesn't say, by the way, which ones by name. The FCC doesn't. Marketplace's Savannah Marr has the story.
Certain rural corners of Washoe County, Nevada, are 20 years behind when it comes to internet access.
There's a community called Gerlach, and it has virtually no access to broadband.
County Manager Eric Brown says you wouldn't know that looking at the FCC's new draft national broadband map, where every single address in Gerlach is marked with a green dot.
It's showing that there's coverage that the residents there are not experiencing.
The map relies on data reported by telecom companies. But according to Greg Geis with the nonprofit Public Knowledge, some of that data is merely aspirational.
The incentive for the provider is to say, I serve that address because it's within the area that I want to serve.
And where established providers don't want competitors getting funding to build out faster or cheaper service.
So it's to exclude potential competitors while they try to get their act together to give consumers broadband.
Telecom trade group CTIA says its members followed FCC guidance in submitting broadband service data. State and local governments had until the end of January to challenge the FCC's map. But Jane Kolodinsky with the University of Vermont says some of the most underserved communities had the least capacity to fight.
If your community does not have the resources in order to follow through on what is a very bureaucratic process,
then it might lose out on once-in-a-generation funding. Nicole Turner-Lee with the Brookings Institution says that's how a little fudge data can have a huge impact.
If by chance we're off, it may not seem like a lot, but it could really be a make-or-break situation.
She says without big investments, rural communities aren't able to fully participate in the broader economy. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Housing's slowing down a bit as mortgage rates look like they're finding something of a level somewhere around the 6.5% mark for a 30-year. And housing adjacent industries are slowing too. We've talked about mortgage brokers. Also, though, remodeling. But even as spending on home improvement is expected to slow, it is still big business in this country. Hundreds of billions of dollars a year big. And really, there's always going to be something that needs or, you know, maybe just wants fixing up. Unlike other kinds of spending, though, people do see home improvement as an investment that pays off when it comes times to sell. But as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, a sure thing, that is not.
You can't miss us, Matt Hampton told me when he gave me his address in suburban Baltimore. And he was right. There's a huge orange dumpster in the front yard, lumber and cinder blocks piled up on the driveway, and a worker on scaffolding laying bricks for what looks like a new garage.
So is this a whole addition you're building?
Yeah, and it gets worse.
Like a lot of home improvement projects these days, Hampton says this one started with the pandemic and the chaos of working at home with two kids, now 14 and 11.
You know, figuring out workarounds for that got a little frustrating. Initially, my wife was working in a window bench.
So they decided to build some dedicated office space. And while they were at it, a new laundry room and guest room and kitchen.
And, you know, these old houses, they're charming, but they are not without their sort of lack of modern conveniences, if you will.
Like mud rooms and big closets. So they added those, too.
You know, it all sort of came to a head when we're like, well, if we are going to do this, well, what about that? And then it sort of, as you can see, blossomed into a bit more.
It blossomed into about a $450,000 addition, which an appraiser told him would probably pay for itself if they sold the house.
And that was actually a big deciding factor of what to do this or not do this.
Most home improvement projects, though, do not pay for themselves, at least according to a new study from Today's Homeowner, a home improvement show and website. Researchers scoured Redfin listings to estimate how much value different improvements added to a home based on its sale price. Then they divided the extra value by the average cost to do the project. Data journalist Shadi Bushra says out of 34 different kinds of remodeling projects in 70,000 homes,
the main finding was that no home improvement project actually adds value to the house above and beyond the cost of what it took to go ahead and do that project.
The only project that broke even was replacing a garage door. That's right, a garage door. Some came pretty close. New wood windows, 96% cost recovery. A screened-in porch, 93%. But the average for all projects was just 69%. And with some of the most common improvements, like an upscale kitchen or bathroom remodel, homeowners only recovered about half the cost.
Bathrooms and kitchens, they are some of the poorest investments you can make.
Financially speaking, that is. Finishing a basement had the smallest return on investment, just 23%. The study looked at professional remodeling projects. The ROI on DIY might be higher. And it's also hard to separate all the factors that go into a home's price. That finished basement might make all the difference for the right buyer.
Right now, the study of resale value for any individual projects is much more of an art than a science.
Carlos Martin follows the remodeling industry at Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies. He points to research showing higher returns on remodeling. The National Association of Realtors estimates bathroom and kitchen renovations can return 70 to 75% of costs, and converting basement space, 86%. Martin says resale price is just one way to measure value.
It could also be that a project that you do decreases your energy bills or it reduces your insurance premiums. It's also because it's valuable to you as a consumer. And at the end of the day, that's really what matters the most.
The Realtors Group calls that the joy score. Cynthia Bliss and Bill Kluel, both retired school teachers, just finished installing a new laundry room/mini kitchen on their second floor. their joy score?
It's like a 10, don't you think?
Oh, this. Oh, yeah.
We're just thrilled with it.
No more hauling laundry up and down two flights of steps to and from the basement.
Walk right out of the bedroom, and there's your laundry room. It's the best thing.
As for the financial return, Bliss doubts they'll ever get back what they've put into the house over the years, but they're not planning to sell anytime soon. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, it's another one for the no, you gotta come back to the office file. Andy Jassy, the CEO of Amazon, sent an all-staff email today. 3 days a week is the new thing for the company. May 1 is the start date. You do kind of have to wonder how many tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands probably, of square feet of office space Amazon has had lying fallow for the past couple of years, huh? All right, we're going. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. We are going to go to next week for this one, Thursday. We'll get an updated reading on economic growth for the end of last year. We were talking about that a little bit, Kate and I were. The first pass at growth in the October to December quarter was 2.9% annualized. Again, Thursday, we get the update. 2.9%, by the way, pretty much the historical average. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you on Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.